Okay, I'll go and get started. I guess the first thing I wanted to say, well, thanks for coming on a day where the World Cup is. I appreciate that. Sort of the second thing that I like to say is that today I'll be focusing on a particular problem that people would like to understand about biological tissues, which is surface tension. But I sort of wanted to point out to this audience that I think there's a lot of interesting problems on the cellular level in biological systems. So a lot of, for example, people who are interested in glasses are interested also in protein folding problems and sort of maybe on some smaller scale problems. But I think there's also some interesting problems on the level of cells, which I think some of the techniques that people use for glasses might be useful for solving. Just to give a few examples, there's a model for epithelial cells, which are skin cells and biological tissues. And that model is a two-dimensional model with a disordered ground state, a very simple disordered ground state. So that's an interesting example. Another interesting thing is that a lot of the motion of cells and tissues exhibits a plateau in the mean squared displacement. So it goes, basically, it has a caging-like behavior and then a diffusive-like behavior. So there's lots of examples, and I won't talk about those today. But if you have questions or want to talk to me more about those ideas, I'd be happy to talk to you about them. Okay, so this work is work done at Princeton with these collaborators, in particular Eva Maria Schutz, who is who took most of the beautiful images that I'll be displaying in this talk. She does the experimental work on zebrafish. Okay. So the first thing I have to explain to you is why I'm talking about surface tension in biological tissues. So the interesting thing is that animal tissues behave like liquids on long time scales. So this is a bright field image of balls of cells. So this is a group of on the order of 10 to the fifth cells, each one of those balls. And as you can see, they're just in a cell culture medium, and they fuse together. These are zebrafish embryonic cells. So I'll play that one more time. And you can basically see that the groups of cells fuse together and form a large droplet. And so the first interesting point is that this is really reminiscent of a liquid-like behavior. One tends to think of your tissues as being solid. But during early embryonic development, especially along time scales, the correct description is often a liquid. And this is just another picture that illustrates that. This is now a confocal slice through a three-dimensional aggregate, which was originally splayed open and then allowed to heal, basically. And it's not a wound healing process, it's just a rounding up process that occurs on short time scales.
Are these movies in real time?
No, not even close. This movie is, I believe, 4 hours, and the scale is about, each aggregate is about 300 microns. And this one is a smaller scale because each cell, well, actually, this one's about 300 microns too. And I believe this one's a little shorter, like 2.5 hours.
And you say these are from zebra embryos that have been splayed open. In the left case, was it split into four pieces?
This is zebrafish embryos at the very earliest stages. And it was just poked, so it was sort of just broken apart, agitated with a pipette tip, and it splayed open. And then they just imaged it while it sort of reformed a ball. So this one wasn't split into four pieces. This one was actually tissues taken from four different embryos. So let me show you, I think on a couple slides I'll be able to show, yeah, this next slide shows you exactly the experimental system that we're looking at. The zebrafish aggregates are really nice experimental system for a few reasons. First, we're doing really early embryonic development. So there's two cells on top of a yolk at the two cell stage. And then in zebrafish, all of the divisions happen all at the beginning. And so you have this cap of cells sitting on top of the yolk. And the nice thing about that is that then after this point is when all of the gastrulation movements, when all of the interesting layers are formed after the cell divisions. So if you're trying to model the system, the nice feature for modeling is you don't have to worry about cell divisions at the same time that you're looking at rheology. In a lot of tissue types, you do. And certainly that's an interesting interplay. But if you're just trying to do the modeling, you can look at them independently in this system, which is very nice. And finally, they're trans.
There are 1,000 cells.
Yeah.
Are
Exactly. So they just get smaller and smaller, the cells do it, as the divisions
cells
occur.
Cells get smaller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting any extra mass here. Yeah. You're just getting fewer, you know, there are more divisions of the mass. And finally, they're transparent, so you can do confocal imaging, and you can actually use, say, the Weeks-Crocker tracking software to track nuclei and all of these nice things. So you can get really interesting data about the motion of cells and these materials.
Okay. Another question.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a limit as of how far the cell divisions can go? Because you're saying that the cells don't enlarge, there is no mass increase. So.
Exactly. So there's a certain point at which this division stops. And it's the same for every embryo. It's after I'm not sure exactly how many cell cycles. I should check. But yeah, you're exactly right. And basically, it stops, and then we start studying it. Okay. And so because these, I'm telling you that these behave as a liquid, one of the things you can measure for these balls of cells is a surface tension. And the way that they do that is they take two parallel plates and compress the ball of cells between those two parallel plates and image it at the same time so they can look at the radii of curvature. And then they just use Laplace's law to extract the surface tension. So at first, of course, you get an elastic response. But on long timescales, the force required to compress this aggregate asymptotes to a constant. And then they also compress this aggregate to different heights. And so the nice thing about that is if you compress it to different heights and you still extract the same surface tension value, that gives you confidence that what you're measuring is really an energy per unit area and not an elastic a component having to do with elasticity in the bulk. Another reason to believe that this is truly a surface tension is you can actually look at the shape of cells in the interior of these aggregates after you've compressed them. And initially, all of the individual cells inside of the packing are flattened and have an aspect ratio very different from one. But on this time scale here, which is on the order of an hour, they round up again, and individual cells inside the packing have an aspect ratio of one again. So basically, the idea is that this that you're measuring out here really is a surface effect. Okay. And so why would anyone care about this? This is the most exciting thing, I think, is that the surface tension can be important for biological function. So there's a particular stage in the development of zebrafish called the shield stage, where the mesendoderm cells move upward and the ectoderm cells move downward. And so mesendoderm are cells that will eventually become your gut, and ectoderm are cells that will eventually become your skin. And so this layering happens during that time. And the idea is that this could actually be a wedding behavior. If you had two different tissue types with two different surface tensions, you could imagine that you could get motion, relative motion between the two, layering and sorting because they have different surface tensions. Okay. And so this is just a picture I have to show because it's so beautiful. This is a histone labeled GFP. So this is just the nuclei you're looking at, not the membrane of the cells. And you can see that an actual zebrafish embryo during the shield stage, and you can see there's some cells moving down this way, but there's also some cells moving up this way in the picture. I'll just show that one more time. So I just think it's
so this is in contact with glass on that side?
No, actually there's a whole bunch of extra stuff going on. It's biology. There's an enveloping layer here. So this is the edge of the aggregate, but there's actually a different type of cell which is sitting out here, and then there's yolk in here. And okay, so there's lots of other things going on. Yes?
So speaking of complicated biology, so are these cells crawling in the limulopodia?
Oh, that's a great question. So on the scale of, if you look at the membranes during this process here, you don't see obvious lamellipodia in the confocal imaging, right? So there are membrane fluctuations, right? But I don't think I know of anybody that studied it extremely carefully, but, you know, there doesn't appear to be at least large protrusions. I mean, they have to be crawling past each other. They don't swim or anything, right? So
what is the mechanism? I presume lamellipodia means feet.
Right. So I think there's also a question of what type of protrusions generate the motion, because there's several different types of protrusions that cells can make to locomote if they do so.
They're essentially swimming in the liquid.
No, I would say that the correct picture is that they're crawling past each other. But the question is to me, is the scale of the protrusions that they're making in order to crawl past one another. And all I was saying to Boris is that the scale of the protrusions that they make in order to crawl are small compared to the radius of the cells.
And here we're imaging, what are we looking at, nuclei?
Yeah, this is histone-labeled GFP in the nuclei of the cells.
So the fact that they don't seem to be in contact
doesn't mean anything. The cell membranes are in contact. In fact, this is packing fraction one, to those of you who do, you know, who do emulsions and things like this. Okay. All right. And so just to show you that this idea that that this could be some sort of wetting behavior isn't crazy, one can measure the surface tension of different types of tissues. So Eva Maria can actually inject mRNA at an early stage, which basically she can make a tissue, a ball of cells of all one tissue type. So all ectoderm or all mesendoderm. And then just take that ball of cells, extract it from the embryo, and compress it, right? So she can get the data on single tissue types. And what she finds is that ones that will become mesendoderm have a significantly lower surface tension than ones that will become ectoderm, or tissue that is will become skin cells. Okay. And so a big question then in the field has been, what mechanical properties can an individual cell change in order to change the macroscopic emergent property of surface tension for the group of cells? And it's important because, for example, if you're designing drugs or thinking about development, you'd like to understand what an individual cell should do in order to generate this emergent behavior. And so the major theory in the literature for a long time was the differential adhesion hypothesis by Steinberg. And essentially, it states that flow arises from differences in tissue surface tensions. And the key part is that he says that in turn arise from differences in intracellular adhesiveness. So an analogy to a liquid, he claims that basically if you get an adhesive bonus from having a nearest neighbor, that on the surface you make fewer contacts than in the bulk, and therefore if you basically change the level of adhesiveness, you change the scale of the surface tension, right? And so that's been the major theory, and there's some nice experimental work sort of supporting that idea. And so this is a plot of the number of surface cations per cell. So that's the number of molecules on the surface that generate these adhesive bonds. And then a plot of the surface tension, which is measured by parallel plate compression. And the fact that this is a nice straight line suggests that, in fact, the surface tension does scale with the adhesion or the number of surface cations per cell, right? But if you're a physicist and you think about it a bit, you say, well, I'm surprised that the number of cations is the only important parameter for determining surface tension, because individual cells have a resistance to stretching. If I take a single cell and I try to deform it, it's going to resist that deformation. And I would think that energy should be important. And of course, there are people that said this is the case. And they said, well, really, it's the interfacial tensions that I should pay attention to, the line tensions along interfaces. And those should be related to both the adhesion and the cortical tension, or the resistance of an individual cell to changing its shape. And so there's a recent experiment that tries to look at this, and there are some issues with it, but I just want to tell you what the experimentalists found. First, they measured the surface tension of now three different tissue types, and they found that and then they ranked them according to their surface tension, and they found ectoderm had the highest surface tension, then mesoderm, then endoderm. Then they performed an AFM experiment where they took a probe coated with cations, pressed it down on top of a cell, pulled it off, and measured the force it took to pull off, and just took that as a measure of the adhesion, which is a little coarse. But they then ordered the tissue types according to this adhesion that they measured with the AFM, and they found now that there was a different order. It went mesoderm, endoderm, ectoderm. And finally, they took another AFM tip, and then they put a bead on, which was coated so that it didn't stick to the surface of the cells. And they pressed down on the cells, and they measured the cells' resistance to that pressure. And then they ordered, and they called that a cortical tension. And so they found, again, that this was ordered ectoderm, mesoderm, endoderm, which, as you can see, is the same ordering as the surface tension. And so they used this experiment to suggest that this cortical tension was important for determining tissue surface tensions. And there's a lot of questions here about the appropriate timescales. So, you know, I can talk to you about that later if you're interested. But I guess the takeaway message is that, you know, it is surprising if the cortical tension doesn't matter, that it doesn't, and maybe it does. Okay. So the questions that I'll try to be answering today is, what specifies surface tension? Is it only the adhesive interactions, or does cortical tension matter? And furthermore, I'll be concentrating on the role of geometry and cell shapes in this process, what the role of structure for determining surface tension. Okay, so just to recall, in a liquid, the surface tension is the difference in energy between a molecule on the surface and that in the bulk. And in the bulk, of course, for liquid, you make more contacts and you get an energy benefit for each contact, and so there's a difference in energy between here and here. And so in analogy, the surface tension for a model would be the difference in mechanical energy, and I'll explain what that means in a moment, between a surface cell and a cell in the interior. And of course, to get the dimensions right, we have to multiply by the number of cells per unit surface area, or divide by the projected area of the cell onto the surface of the aggregate. And so now comes the crux. How do I determine what ingredients are important for the energy for deforming a cell inside this aggregate? And there's lots of possibilities. Cortical elasticity is one. So you have an actin network, which has an elasticity. There's some particularly beautiful recent work on active cortical tension. And so the idea here is that if you have an actin gel and there's active myosin motors acting on that gel, that the behavior of that actin actually is like a liquid. And you can actually describe it using some liquid crystal theory. And so the bottom line, though, for the purposes of this talk, is that they predict, and then there's some recent experiments that show that if you basically deform the cortical layer, which is this layer of actin network, which is right near the surface of the cell, it behaves like a fluid. It has a surface tension like a fluid. So individual cells resist changes to their shape like a fluid, and we'll call that a cortical tension. And it's different, by the way, from a membrane tension. In this problem, the membrane tension of the vesicle, sort of the membrane of the individual cells, is irrelevant. It's much, much smaller than this cortical tension. Okay. And of course, surface adhesion, which is that there are these molecules, these cations that basically bind together and lower the energy. And finally, there are bulk effects, such as the fluid resisting dilation and compression, and also the cytoskeleton possibly resisting shear. I'm going to go to the next slide, but I just am going to say really quickly I'm going to focus on the ones that are highlighted in green. And these are the three ingredients I'm going to put in my model, and I'm going to neglect elasticity. And the reason why is because I'm interested in processes that occur on the timescale of 10 minutes or more. And on those timescales, the rheology of the cell has a much larger sort of loss modulus than storage modulus. It really does behave more like a liquid on those timescales. Furthermore, if you look at a confocal image of cells inside an aggregate, this is the green is the membranes of cells, and the blue is the nuclei. And you can see that in this image, the corners actually between the polyhedra are really sharp. And so if you write down a model with elasticity in it, there's not a very large parameter regime in which you can get sharp corners. And that sort of makes sense, right? If you have some bending energies or you have some elasticity to the model, it really won't have sharp corners to these interfaces. Okay, so therefore we'll write down the model, which is, first of all, it's incompressible. These are animal cells. It's very different for plant cells. Plant cells can change their volume, but it seems to be a good approximation that animal cells don't. Do you have a question?
I have a question because if I understand not the previous but the slide just before, what you're looking at now, you want to define the surface tension over an ensemble of cells by looking at the energy of the cell inside versus the energy of the surface. That's what you're
yes.
Defining. But before, every data you showed us was at the level of a single cell. No, I mean the data when you were pressing on.
No, that was an aggregate.
Oh, that was an aggregate.
Yeah, so it's always, and that's a good point. So there are plenty of experiments which actually do pipette aspiration of single cells and look at single cell rheology, and individual cells have a surface tension themselves. But it's also interesting that together the aggregate has a surface tension, which are in some ways different from that of single cells.
The one where you pinch were also aggregates.
No, the AFM experiments, sorry. The AFM experiments were on single cells. And it's exactly the point, is that was one of the first experiments that was really trying to get at how you go from properties of single cells to properties of aggregates. Okay. And so the cells are incompressible to a good approximation. And then we can ask, and then we'll write down the following mechanical energy. There's a contribution, the energy increases when the total perimeter, so this is the total perimeter here, or the total surface area in 3D is increased. And this parameter we'll call the cortical tension. Yeah. First of all, when we do confocal imaging of the cells, we can get Z slices, right? And so we don't have a fine resolution in Z, but to when we do Z slices for individual cells, and then we can definitely get a good estimate of their area in the plane, and they don't change area. So that's one. The second thing is that. So for the zebrafish tissues that we're looking at, my claim is that when we look at the volume, so I have a 2D model which I have area, but for 3D, that the volume doesn't change to some good approximation, which is very different from some types of epithelial cells, right? But I guess Matthias Kashube also has this tool where he can he's trying to do 3D reconstructions. And so actually to a very good approximation in his epithelial layers even, the volume of those cells doesn't change, which I found incredibly surprising, but you know, they have really good data on it now. And our approximation suggests it is true too. So that's why I'm saying that. Okay, and it's definitely not true again for plant cells. Plant cells don't do this at all. Okay, then there's a term where the energy is decreased when you have a perimeter in contact with other cells, so that's what the piece of C suggests, and then we have this incompressibility constraint. That's it. So this, as you can see, is a very minimal model for the energy of deformation of a single cell. And with that minimal model, we'd like to find the global minimum energy shape for a collection of cells subject to the constraints. And so the point is this.
Let me just go back. What was the difference between PC and PT?
This is the contact perimeter, and this is the total perimeter. So if you have cells on the edge of it, let me go to the next picture because that's easier to say.
If you have cells
on the edge, then they have a different. So in the bulk, PC is equal to PT, but okay. On the edge, it's not. That's it. And so, by the way, I should say that it's also possible to formulate this whole model in terms of line tensions along this interface and line tensions along that interface. But since I'm really interested in trying to compare cortical tension to adhesion, I work in this other framework. Okay. So the point is that in general, it's difficult to figure out the minimum energy shape because you have to write down a functional of all the geometries possible for these cells and make sure force balances is satisfied. But for a two-dimensional ordered packing, it's actually simple. So what I'm going to do is say I'm going to constrain everything to be ordered, to have the symmetry in 2D of hexagons, and then I'm going to see what I can do under that constraint. And the point is that if I make that constraint that these cells have to remain ordered and they're in this packing, then because I have a constant area constraint, I can actually specify the structure completely by one parameter, which is this length of the side that cells have in contact with one another at the surface. And so that's nice because I don't need to do a functional derivative anymore. I just need to take a derivative with respect to this parameter. which is nice. And so just to be clear, the reason I can do that, right, is because I have the symmetry. These cells have to be the same on the sides. And also, since the area is constrained, then if I change L side, I have to change L cap, right?
So yeah. The area of the cell is constant, you say, but it has a membrane. The cell has a membrane. Does it have a constant surface area, or in this case, a compact perimeter also?
No, the perimeter changes. And the idea is that that's a contribution to the energy when it does. And it's, again, it's not, these actually you can do tethering experiments on the membranes of these cells, and the membrane isn't limited. You can pull out long tethers on the membranes. So what's really limiting is this cortical, active cortical tension on the network. So that's a reason. I mean, so the point is you really do have a lot of room to expand this perimeter in these cells because it's not a constraint on the membrane material.
Is that an unusual feature of these cells? Do most cells have fixed
perimeters? So I don't know about most cells. I would say I know of two other examples where the perimeter appears to change, LP1 and LP2 cells, which are sort of cancer lines.
I was thinking of like red blood cells, like red
blood cells. Yeah, red blood cells, I think, are different, right? Because they really have a true elastic. Red blood cells are very funny. Well, I mean, they're all cell. Each cell is funny in its own way. The hope is that embryonic tissues are similar to one another before they become differentiated. And I would say in that case, I'm aware of several experiments where they do this tethering experiment where they try to pull the membrane, and they can pull it a long way without resistance, just the membrane, not the cortical network. So that suggests that a lot of different cells have these reservoirs. Okay. So then, since we don't need to, so we can find this shape, the minimum energy shape of these cells, as a function of the ratio between the adhesion and the cortical tension then. So for every value of the ratio between the adhesion and cortical tension, you find a different minimum energy shape. And then, because you know the shapes, you know the energies, and then you can calculate the surface tension according to our prescription. Again, and you can do it analytically. And so this is a plot of the surface tension. Then, so this again is the ratio of the so it's the difference in energy between a surface cell and an interior cell divided by the projected length onto the surface of the aggregate. And so this is this emergent behavior, and this is the ratio between the mechanical properties of a single cell, the adhesion and the cortical tension. And so I think the important feature to notice on this plot is that this thing is almost a straight line. So the red line is to guide your eye. The red line is the differential adhesion hypothesis. It suggests that the surface tension scales with the adhesion and that the cortical tension doesn't matter because I've non-dimensionalized the surface tension by the cortical tension. And so this actually looks a lot like the Fodian-Steinberg experiment, where they look at the number of cadherins and they measure the surface tension. Also, I think this is sort of interesting. There's actually this cavitation transition in the model, which I just thought I would mention briefly. So the idea is that there's a lot of models for cells and tissues that assume that the cells are packed into polygons and have sharp corners. And so an interesting question is, are polygons the minimal energy shapes really for this energy functional, right? And so naively, of course, if you don't have any, well, not naively, if you don't have any adhesion, then you expect the shapes to be spherical in 3D or circular in 2D, right? If I don't have any benefit of making contacts with neighbors, my minimum energy state had better be a circle, right? And so you know it has to transition from a circle to a polygon. And naively, I thought that, well, the radius would get smaller and smaller and smaller as I increase the adhesion. But there's actually a continuous transition from having a finite radius to having perfectly sharp corners in this model. And so that's nice because it means that if you have a model where you're just assuming polygons, you're basically right in a large region of phase space. So if I go back here, this cavitation transition is right down here. So above this point, you have polygons. Okay, so that's nice. Okay, and you can also do the same thing in 3D. And so the way that I do it, you of course have a choice of unit cell in 3D. I use Kelvin cells, and so then you can basically, Kelvin cells are the Wigner-Seitz cell of a BCC lattice. And so I'm going to construct an ordered packing of a bunch of these. Now I can analyze their shapes at the surface. I can calculate their shapes as a function of the ratio, again, between the adhesion and the cortical tension and do the same thing. And then you get a very similar plot. It has a bit more curvature, but generically very similar. Okay. But so the real point here, of course, is that real structures aren't ordered. They're very disordered. And so the important question is that, as we know from thinking about glasses, sometimes you don't really learn much about the disordered states from studying the ordered states, right? And so a worry could be is that I did a bunch of this work. Do I really understand anything about the disordered states? Of course, the answer, I wouldn't be telling you this if the answer wasn't yes, but let me go through it. So this is an image of a more disordered aggregate generated by the program surface evolver. And in two dimensions, the point is that the topology is constrained. The topological Gauss-Bonnet theorem tells me that since these things both have the topology of a disk, I have to have six disclinations. But of course, in the disordered aggregate, I can have many defect pairs. And so the question then becomes, do these defect pairs, how do they alter this surface tension? And they could alter this difference in energy, or they could alter the projected length, or they could alter them in some crazy way as a function of the ratio between the adhesion and the cortical tension. So what I did to look at this was I actually generated disordered packings by taking a Voronoi tessellation of point patterns with a pair correlation function, which was similar to that of the nuclei locations in the zebrafish aggregates. Okay, so I start out with this Voronoi tessellation that's disordered. And then I use the program surface evolver, which basically looks for minimum energy cellular structures, starting from that initial state and going to the nearest local minimum. And I do that for many different initial configurations of this Voronoi tessellation for different values of the ratio between gamma and beta. Okay, what I find was really surprising to me. Namely, I found that these defect pairs, for each defect pair, I can look at the difference in energy, and I can look at the length, the projected length onto the surface. And the surprising thing is that the projected length changes much, much more than the change in energy. And so basically, the effect of these defect pairs for these cellular structures is just to change the perimeter of the structure. It allows this relaxation from a hexagon to a circle. And because in this model, the cells all have to have the same area, these numerical results suggest the following sort of ridiculously simple ansatz, which is that the only difference between the disordered and the ordered structure is that there's a different perimeter. This one has to have circular symmetry because it's disordered. This one, of course, has to have hexagonal symmetry. And so it's just the ratio between the perimeter of a hexagon to the perimeter of a circle of the same area, which is this number. And so what I'm saying is that I have this analytic calculation, and I multiply it by a number, and now I'm going to make a prediction for disordered structures. Okay.
So would you expect the zebrafish picture to evolve to this something that looks like this thing that you have there?
So what you're saying, this picture?
Yeah.
So in 3D, the 3D version of, right, because I don't have two-dimensional aggregates. And so an interesting question is when I don't have the similar constraints of the topological Gauss-Bonnet, you know, the topological Gauss-Bonnet theorem is really strict in 2D and less strict in 3D, basically, right? So what I'm saying is that it's actually true that 2D slices through the zebrafish aggregates do look exactly like this. But, you know, quantifying that, what you really should do is do the same surface evolver program in three dimensions and do 3D reconstructions of the zebrafish aggregate to answer that question specifically. What I'm really going to be interested in, and I'll get back to that in a moment, is sort of the curvature of the edges. Okay.
So to what extent is aggregates actually fluid, and to what extent they are frozen?
So
this is frozen, right?
So I'm looking at local inherence. The way that I think about it is that the zebrafish aggregates are like a supercooled liquid. They have, in the mean square displacement, they have a caging behavior, they have a diffusive. And the way I'm looking at this is I'm looking at the inherent states of that of the structure that are related. So the actual cells are going to be higher energy than this because they're transitioning between states. But what I'm looking at is sort of the inherent structures. So I think that the aggregates themselves are not, they're clearly not frozen. But I think that they're close enough. I mean, individual cells in these aggregates are very rarely anything but aspect ratio 1. And so to transition between states, which are higher energy, happens rarely, basically. And so the idea is that they're close to inherent states in the pictures. Okay. So then, this is the so this is the sort of plot that shows. So this is the prediction. It's just the analytic prediction now, but now it's for a disordered system. And these red stars are the solutions to many surface evolver minimizations. And this inset shows the error bars. And so the point is that this simple ansatz does a remarkably good job of predicting the surface tension now for disordered structures. So really, I've learned something about the disordered structures from my analysis of the ordered structures. Oh, and for those of you who are interested, this point is approximately what the answer for a dry foam. A dry foam has a ratio of gamma over beta of 1. And there's actually some papers in the literature on the surface energy of foams. And they and actually, the one paper that I found on this is not right, actually. So this is a different way of calculating, if you're interested in the surface energy of foams as well. Okay. I can tell you, I have a slide on it if you're interested in why the paper in the literature isn't right. But. Okay, so then you can also look at what these aggregates look like. So at very low adhesions in this model, you get aggregates which have a sort of bumpy surface, a rounded surface, and that's because they don't get an energy benefit from making contacts with their nearest neighbors, really. And then at the very high end, you basically get very smooth aggregates, again, because they get such an energy benefit from making contacts with neighbors. Okay, and so now we can look and see what happens in the experimental system. So this is an SEM image of LP1 cells, and this is a control aggregate with a really high surface tension, well, relatively high surface tension. What you see here is just an aggregate where there's lots of cells in this aggregate, and you really can't distinguish them. So you can see what I mean. I'm going to show you the next picture. This is what happens if you add cytoskeletal drugs that interfere with the, both the cortical tension and the adhesion. And in these lower surface tension aggregates, you see that the cells are much more rounded at the edges. And so the nice thing is that this sort of is a simple explanation for something that the experimentalists have noticed for a long time, that high adhesion aggregates are shiny and low adhesion aggregates look rough. Okay. So that's the idea. And here's the similar plot for 3D surface tension with the ansatz for the disordered structure. Okay. And so the idea is that this sort of minimal model is like the differential adhesion hypothesis, because cells do get an energy bonus for having adjacent neighbors, right? So that's an ingredient in the model. But like the differential interfacial tension hypothesis, the cells are not point objects, and therefore their energy depends on their shape. And furthermore, the interfacial tensions do differ. But when you take into account the shape changes that occur as these cells are aggregating because they're looking for their local minimum energy structure, you find that, perhaps surprisingly, that even though you include this cortical tension as an important ingredient, the differential adhesion hypothesis is mostly right for these systems. It basically, the point is that it really does matter. You can count your neighbors up here, and it does matter how many neighbors you have on the surfaces compared to the bulk. But of course, that's not the end of the story. So while we were working on this project, my experimental collaborator came to me and mentioned, you know, in these really high adhesion aggregates, there's something interesting going on with the surface cells. So let me show you a picture of what that is. So let me tell you what I'm going to show you before I show it to you. So these are membrane stainings of the aggregate. And what I'm going to show you is a movie that sort of starts out on the surface of the sphere and then goes inward. And so what you'll see, the first slide is the surface cells. And then the next slide through is going to be still surface cells, but then you're starting to get into the bulk cells that are below the surface. But along the edges, you'll still see surface cells. So let me show you the movie. I'll show it twice. OK, so we're slicing through like this. And what you can, it's not too good. But you can see that the surface cells are, can you see that surface cell that's still stretched out here? And then there are cells in the bulk which are remained compact. I'll show it to you again. So again, the surface cells out here are stretched out. And then the interior bulk cells are more compact. But yet, the cells on the surface are stretched out, right? And one thing you can ask, well, are the surface cells changing their volume? for example, but they're not. If you look at the number of Z slices you can make through, these, the volumes of these are really the same as the volumes of those cells on the interior. The second thing, if you're, especially if you're a biologist, you say, well, the surface cells are very different, maybe in some way from the cells in the bulk. Maybe they're differentiated. So the first thing we thought to do was look for epithelial markers, because some cells that will become skin-like cells have try to form layers, and there are markers for that. And there are no markers for epithelia in the types that we were looking at, where we see these stretched-out cells. And furthermore, we looked at a small aggregate in nuclei and waited to see if we could see a cell diffuse away from the surface into the bulk, right? And this is an image that the coloring is artificial, obviously. So you can see that there's an exchange where there's a cell that moves to the surface and one that moves to the interior, right? And so the idea is that this type of diffusion is going on between the cells, and therefore you at least the cells in the bulk aren't different on the time scale of 10 minutes from the cells on the surface, right? Okay. So then the question is, well, if they're not so differentiated, how can we understand what's going on in these and for these stretched out cells? And so the intuitive idea is that if you have a large adhesive energy, it's much larger than other energies, then the surface cells want to satisfy that energy and spread out to make the same surface area in contact on the surface as they do in the bulk. Of course, there's questions of, well, what regulates that spreading out and things like that. But the first thing I want to show you is, can we ask the question, are they spreading out to make the same surface area on the surface as they are in the bulk? And so how do we do that? So the first point is that hopefully in another year or two, with tools like the one Matthias is developing to really do good 3D reconstructions of these tissues, we'll be able to answer that question by just going in and measuring the surface area. But right now, we can't do that. And so what you can do instead is, in the model, you can calculate how many cells a surface cell will have to spread out in order to make the same perimeter in 2D or surface area in 3D of contact with a bulk, as a bulk cell. So in this cartoon, you can see that the surface cell in 2D has to spread out over roughly 3 cells to make the same area in contact as a cell in the bulk. And of course, there's some subtleties, right? First of all, you have to have force balance. So as soon as you lose a vertex, you change this area here, right? And also, you can make contact with nearest neighbors on the surface. But it turns out that you can calculate all these things, and these two effects basically cancel. And so the answer really is about 3 for 2D. And then you can also do the same thing for a 3D ordered packing. Now there's an additional complication, which you have two facets of the three-dimensional crystal, and so you have to calculate those facets separately. But you can do it. And so then you take an average, and you get 3.7 as the number of cells you spread out over to make the same surface area of contact. And so then we can actually measure that in the experiments. So this is, again, just an image of a cross-section through the bulk cells perpendicular to the, you know, surface of the, parallel to the surface of the sphere. And these are surface cells, again, a cross-section parallel to the surface of the sphere going in. And so this scale bar is the same. So you can see that these cells are a lot larger, have a lot larger projected area than these cells, and you can measure the ratio for many different aggregates. And we see that it's 3.7. And so the idea here is that it does seem to be consistent with the idea that these surface cells are spreading out to make the same amount of contact as cells in the bulk. So the first point is that independent of any model, this means that the differential adhesion hypothesis, as stated, can't be correct for these aggregates, because the surface cells are stretching to make the same contact area, and there's no difference in their number of adhesive aggregate contacts, right? And so we know that that can't be right in that regime when they're stretched out. But then the question is, well, what happens? The first question is, can the minimal model I've described so far explain those observations? And so what you can actually do is, it turns out that you're not limited to having compact cells on the surface of these ordered aggregates. You can do the same calculation for the surface tension as a function of stretching out over any integer number of cells. Well, actually, any integer up to 4, because if you go above 4, then you don't have enough area and you have to start making concave contacts, which don't satisfy force balance. But you can go up to 4 in 2D, and then you can calculate the surface tension as a function of the ratio between the adhesion and the cortical tension for different integer values. Of course, you could do non-integers too, but then you break the symmetry that I imposed on this problem in the first place, and you can't do it analytically anymore. Okay, but this is the results, and so you can see that especially as I get to higher ratios of the adhesion and the cortical tension, I could expect to see metastable states quite often, actually, of stretching out over 2 or 3 surface cells, because they're not that different in energy from the compact cells. But certainly, I would expect to see more stretched out over 2 cells than stretched out over 3 cells, for example, because they have lower energy. And it really appears in these surface cells that they have a nice sort of regular size to them. There's not this sort of distribution that you would expect from a picture like this. And so the question is what happens? I've shown all of these plots up to 2. And 2 is basically on the edge of having a negative line tension in the minimal model. And so you can ask, well, it's certainly possible that I could put enough cadherins on the surface of my cells in order to give myself a negative line tension. And so I would start to spread out. And so the question is, what happens above here? And can we extend this minimal model to try to understand what's going on for these stretched cell states? Okay, yeah.
I don't have to worry what happens to actin. So with there's so many examples of cortical actin assembly being cadherin dependent.
Yes.
So if you remove it, it moves back. So for example, in these cells, is the surface without cadherin, or at least without cadherin contacts outside, what happens to actin?
It's a really good question. So as long as the effect of the actin, effect of the actin is to generate cortical tension, then one can actually, we could go into the details together later, but the idea is simply that actually what this gamma is that I've been calling an adhesion is an effective adhesion, and it's basically a bare adhesion, which is sort of like a free energy of cadherin bonds, minus 2 times the difference in cortical tension locally at interfaces which are contacting and interfaces which are non-contacting. And a really interesting question that sort of we've been debating is whether this quantity is positive or negative. Whether if you, so the question, because this term is actually some, so it can either be bigger than the bare energy of adhesion or not, depending on the sign. And there's sort of differences in experiments. So in the zebrafish tissues, it appears that the cortical network is actually much stronger at interfaces. It's actually increased, and there's some data that suggests that. But there's also some data by Nelson's group that suggests actually that there's this pathway where actually the cortical tension is upregulated away from contact. So if this is a contact between 2 cells, the cortical tension is actually upregulated out here instead of along this interface, and then that would have different sign. And I think actually there's some suggestion that the difference is whether it's an epithelial cell or not. Okay, so, but it's really important actually, the feedback between the cortical tension and the adhesion. Does that answer your question? Okay, but the nice thing is because they scale the same way in the model, you can sort of make an effective parameter out of them. Okay, so if the adhesion is larger than the cortical tension, then of course this model says there's an instability in the bulk. And what I'm going to suggest is that that certainly you could get negative line tensions, but you're not going to have cells that turn into giant pancakes. And so there must be some regulatory mechanism in the cell to prevent some second order terms to prevent them from continuing to spread. There's a negative line tension. And I'm going to just write it as a second order term. And there's a couple possibilities for where this second order term comes from. The first I would suggest is adhesion molecule regulation. So basically, if the cell regulates the total number of adhesion molecules that it presents to the surface, then that would give rise to a term like this. Another intriguing possibility is that because the cortical network become, at least in our zebrafish tissues, becomes more and more dense near contacts, you could also imagine that you get a larger and longer lived storage modulus for the actin network as it becomes more dense. Okay, so either one would give rise to a term like this, which again is proportional to the contact perimeter here in the that's squared. And so if you add this term, and then you can solve the model again, right? So you add the second order term, solve the model again, and this is what you find. So this is the region I showed you before, where the compact cells are the lowest energy states. And so again, you find that the adhesion scales with the surface tension in this regime. But then there's a crossover, and the sharpness of this crossover depends on that elasticity constant. There's sort of a natural choice for it if people want to talk about it, but okay. When the adhesion is large, then basically there's this crossover to this behavior where the cortical tension dominates, the cells are stretched out, and they're stretched out over the right amount to make the same number of contacts in the bulk as on the surface. Okay? And so this is nice because it suggests a way to explain sort of what might be contradictory experimental data. This is like the data by Foti and Steinberg that show that the surface tension scales with the number of adhesion molecules, but then we expect there to be a regime when these surface cells are stretched out where the cortical tension should in fact matter. Okay. So to conclude, the confocal images in AFM data suggest that both adhesion and cortical tension are important for cell-cell mechanics. And using this as a minimal model, we've developed a method to calculate exact solutions for ordered structures. And then we find for those solutions that the surface tension increases with the adhesion, and that the differential adhesion hypothesis is approximately satisfied. And another point is that the disordered structures are related to ordered structures in a remarkably simple way. And finally, for very high adhesion aggregates, the surface cells are stretched. And again, in a model-independent way, the differential adhesion hypothesis cannot hold in that regime, but we have developed an extension to the model which also explains sort of the details for that case. Okay, so there's a paper on this it's not even published yet, but it's available online in PNAS. And these are my collaborators, and I'd like to also thank the Princeton Center for Theoretical Science, where I'm at. Yeah. So one question is what we're trying to do now is design a laser ablation experiment where you go in and you actually ablate with the laser the interfaces between the cells, so we can test and see what these tensions are, right, as a function of, say, the ratio between the adhesion and the cortical tension. So we have these cell lines that, we don't have them. Ramsey has them that are basically express different levels of cadherin. So we can look as a function of this gamma parameter. And then we're trying to get time at a facility to basically cut these bonds, look at the response of the system in response to these cut bonds, and extract what the tension was on those lines beforehand, so we can begin to understand whether we have this second order term or not. If you have a second order term, I guess Frank Hulicker has shown that you get an anisotropy in the response. If you have an elasticity, you get an anisotropy in the response to the broken line tension, as opposed to if it's just a tension, if it's just a fluid tension. So that's our hope, that we could do that in the bulk and then see. I mean, because it is an ansatz that there's the second order term. It's just, it has to be there, something like it has to be there to keep things stable. And the question is you could also imagine there could be roughening. I mean, there's lots of ways, actually, that, you know, this could happen. And so we should test it. It is something which we put in because we think it has to be there.
So you don't have enough of a physics model to understand what the RH is.
Like I said, there's sort of two interesting candidates, which we also might be able, there's some talk of trying to be able to test those candidates sort of from the biochemical pathway perspective. One is adhesion molecule regulation. So one thing we could do is try to upregulate the adhesion molecules and see where it saturates and how it saturates, you know, just by looking at the response of the cells to that. And then a second candidate is actually an increase in the storage modulus of the cortical network as you get more and more dense cortical network near contacts. And so that's presumably something we could also try and test explicitly.
Can you
having this figured out under some kind of thermodynamics and statistical physics and minimizing the free energy and so on. So I guess my question is this statistical physics at room temperature, or do you need some effective temperature to what is the scale of the energy barriers that you are?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't know, because of course, where I want to go with this is dynamics, right? And so, certainly, I'm not talking about the thermal temperature that's activating the over barriers, because in this system, the thermal temperature is much too small to overcome the barriers in the system. However, it appears that if you look at, say, the power spectrum of the noise of motion of cells in these aggregates, it looks like white noise. And so the idea is that this crawling around of cells on one another is an active process, you know, generated by the cells, and that the idea might be is that that could really be a temperature allowing exploration of different states. But sort of related to your question, I think, is, I mean, so that's one answer, is that first, there really is a sort of a temperature-like analog that is driving the motion. But there's also the question is there a configurational temperature to this system? In other words, what's the density of configurational states in the structure? And, you know, if we're trying to do rheology, do we need a true effective temperature in addition to this sort of fake motion temperature to get over to explain the statistical mechanics? And that's an open question.
But you have a hundred of this, right? For example, starting the stars and
so one thing you can do is you can apply cytochalasin, which is a drug. So you can apply drugs which act quickly and are reversible, and that destroys the liquid-like behavior in the system. So you know, if that's your question, you know that the what's ever allowing you to get over energy barriers is an active process. So yeah.
In these 3D walls of cells, I mean, they must be able to scan through, get the structure, right, the packet. So then you have a prediction for how many defects are in there, and does it work?
Well, so an interesting question. So what we can't do is a true construction of the interfaces, you know, of the actual interfaces. And these things aren't exactly spheres, right? So all we can do is take a Voronoi tessellation of the nuclei. That's the best we can do to get at the structure, right? And so the question is
because they can't image this.
Yeah, live imaging on, because these things are, you know, you have to put a fluorescent marker in there to look at the membranes, and you have to do live imaging if you want to get any sort of. So one thing you can do, right, and people are starting to try to do this, is do 3D reconstructions on fixed aggregates. So if you just want static things,
that would be good enough for
me, right? And so people are, the techniques to do that are just being imported now. So it's sort of one of those things. I mean, we know how to do it in soft condensed matter, but importing that to work on the biology, it's not that it's that hard, it's just people are just starting to do it now. So I don't have access to that data. The only thing I have access to is sort of the nuclei positions in 3D. And even that, you know, is just starting to be really, you know, to get for multiple aggregates and things like that. But I agree that's where we should go. Yeah. I guess World Cup time?
That's a good one.